You're listening to Spilling Ink.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a very special live edition of Spilling Ink, the talk show that takes you behind the scenes in the writing world. We talk to authors and publishers, agents, graphic designers, pretty much anyone who has a part in making our books great. With us tonight, we have myself, Jason. We have Katie Salitis, our beautiful co-host. Hi, Katie.
Hello.
I love your new hair this week.
It's purple. It's really, really purple.
You look like someone I would find in the capital of the Hunger Games.
Oh, good.
The bright hair.
That's kind of what I was going for.
Very good. Well, our guests tonight are Terry Hill and Elliot Brandis. How are you guys doing tonight?
Thank you. How are you?
Good. You're quiet over there, Elliot. I can hardly hear you.
I think my audio cut out, so I'm trying to fix it.
Never fails. There's always a technical difficulty.
Oh yeah. Well, we'll jump over to Terry. Terry, how's it going tonight?
Doing great. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very, very well. Well, tell us a little bit about yourself, Terry.
By day, I'm a NASA engineer. Been working for close to 20 years. Spent about a decade doing spacesuit design. The other 10 years, other 5.5 years doing various and sundry other things. That's by day, and then by night I write science fiction and speculative fiction, and sometimes a little bit of this and a little bit of that. It doesn't fall into either of those categories.
Excellent. Now, can you tell me, because I get mixed answers on this, how do you define speculative fiction?
That's a good question, and you know, it's the way I define it, maybe it's wrong, but what way I've heard it mostly described is anything that's plausible but has a bit of a scientific twinge to it, or science fiction, or a little bit supernatural bent to it, but not pure fiction, you know.
Okay. All right, Elliot, are you with us now?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
You can hear me? Is it good, loud and clear?
It's good, loud and clear and beautiful. All right, so Elliot has been on the show. It's been a little over a year, I think, since we've talked to you, though. Can you kind of refresh us? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so I write as S. Elliot Brandis. As you might tell from the accent, I'm from Australia. Currently back in Australia. I think last time we spoke, I was in Peru. So slightly different scenery. So I'm working at time zones like a boss now. I started out writing more, I guess, science fiction space. So post-apocalyptic sort of stuff was where I started. And I've slowly moved more and more into writing horror stuff. It's always good fun. So my books are getting slightly bloodier day by day, slightly gorier, slightly more fun. And that's where I'm at now.
Yeah, there's a big change going from Irradiated to a young slasher, right?
Yeah, and even just in terms of the writing style as well, I've sort of, you know, changed that as I've moved on as well.
Okay, awesome. So tonight we're going to be talking a little bit about authors behaving badly, and we all, every one of us, even myself, as hard for it is for you guys to believe, even I have my bad moments where I think or say or do stupid things. And as an author, as someone who is, I don't consider myself a public figure because I'm not a big time author. I'm not famous. However, the public can see me. So if I write something, if I'm just a total a-hole online to someone or on my status, people are going to see that. And if I've wronged someone, I expect to get beat down a little bit on it. But what we wanted to talk tonight about is the bullying that sometimes occurs online. Very recently, there was a young woman who is an author who was targeted and bullied to the point where she attempted suicide.
Cover artist.
It was a pretty tragic situation where And to be honest with you, it doesn't even matter what she did. What matters to me is that so many people came out and trolled her and messaged her and harassed her and attacked her to the point where she felt like she had to go to these extremes and hurt herself. And it's a terrible thing. I hate to see that in our community. I hate to see it in the schools with my own children. And thankfully they haven't been the targets of bullying too much, but you know, it's something that's been around forever. And now with the digital age, it's easier than ever to bully someone else. So I wanted to find out from you two guests, what have your experiences been online so far? You know, have you had pretty positive experiences being a writer and being online? Have you had some negative experiences? What has it been like for you?
Yeah, so I've largely been fairly fortunate with that. My experience has been, you know, largely the community has been very supportive and everything. You know, the tricky thing with writing science fiction is that there's a large contingent out there that feels obligated to keep it to hardcore science fiction and really tied to the science part, so that, you know, you have to keep all the physics plausible and sit down to the nth detail. And, you know, it's really tricky if you're writing science fiction. If you're going to write hardcore, you really need to pay attention to the facts. Otherwise, people are going to call you on it. Otherwise, you need to keep the science not the focus of your stories. And, you know, that kind of helps deflect a little bit about that. But, you know, I've really seen the bullying more on some of my fellow authors, not so much in the science fiction area, but in like the paranormal and the romance side of things. That really gets pretty hot and pretty mean over there in those genres at times.
Yeah. And we talk a lot, especially when we're speaking to new authors and people who are releasing their debut books. And one thing that's said a lot is thick skin. You got to have thick skin. It is true, you know, because we're going to get bad reviews. We're going to have someone who trashes us on Goodreads or Amazon, and you're going to see it, and part of you might want to cry a little bit. Part of you might be pissed off, but that's unfortunately part of the game. However, I think that there's a big difference between having thick skin and being realistic and becoming a target. So, you know, it's crazy. Some of the stuff that goes on out there. Elliot, have you ever had any bad experiences out there being online?
No, I've been reasonably fortunate in. I think as my books have sold more, I tend to get more positive stuff, so emails and well wishes, and I haven't really experienced the bad side, but I tend to not to put myself out there too much with, you know, political opinions and all of those sorts of things, because people seem very eager to latch on to something and turn it into this giant storm out of a, you know, out of a teacup. And I've done well so far, touch wood, at avoiding that sort of controversy. But yeah, sometimes it's hard, and sometimes even when someone has done something wrong, the reaction is often way over the top with, you know, with their original crime. It's like a, I don't know, it's like this primal kind of ganging up instinct that people seem to have.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, and I'm a pretty darn nice guy to everybody I meet, but there's something about getting in the car and driving, and if you're in traffic, that just, it brings out the stupid in me. And I don't road rage. I don't get, you know, don't start driving crazy or yelling at people, but I get these angry thoughts like, I wish that person would just drive off the road. And I'm like, where the hell did that come from? Why would my mind even think something like that? And I think that you're absolutely right. When people see a certain post, it's almost like they're just eager. They want to dive in, and they want to see blood in the water. And then as soon as there's blood in the water, we all know what happens at that point.
Well, I think you touched on a point. It was because, you know, with technology the way it is now, and the internet and the web and everything, it's, you know, before all the other social media didn't allow for that mob mentality to take place, right? Yeah. You know, back in the old days, you know, if a mob took place, they all had to be physically present because, you know, before the internet, you had newspapers and books. And, you know, if someone wrote a bad review or criticized somebody in the newspaper article, people would read it and they would nod their heads and say yes, but they couldn't actually engage in that. But now with instant access to post your own opinions and to follow up with that, it's kind of turned into a digital mob environment. And some of the primal, like you said, the primal instincts have come out, and that's really kind of what fuels that fire, unfortunately.
The other side of it, too, is there you're not able to look the other person in the eye. So when you say something, you know, hurtful on the internet, you're just typing words out on a screen. You can't see the impact of your words on that other person. You don't know how it feels. And because there's that disconnect, the mob gets worse because they feel like there's really no consequence. It's just words on a screen. But there really are people on the other side that are affected and are hurting by the words that are said.
Oh, yeah. People get very, very brave and bold on the other side of the keyboard.
Now, Katie, you've been writing for quite a while. You have a lot of books out there. You have a huge social following on a number of different platforms. What are some of your experiences, you know, either positive or negative with the writing community?
You know, I avoid drama. Like, you know, there's going to be disagreements over the years. You know, you make friends with other authors. Sometimes you are not friends with them after a while for whatever reason. But there's no reason to get into an online battle with anybody. So the moment that I see that happening, and I've seen it in a lot of different online groups, I tend to just back away. I really don't need the drama. I've got enough work to keep me busy. I've got my own goals to, you know, to work through. There's no time for fighting. There's no time for squabbling. You know, head down and get work.
I agree. And, you know, I think that we've, early on in the show, this was one of our pieces of advice to young authors was to never reply to the bad reviews. Never reply to the criticism, because holy shit, down the rabbit hole you will go, and it's not a fun place to be. I mean, there are people that just want to be mean and want to leave you a mean review, and engaging with those people is going to end with disaster. And then there are those people that just genuinely didn't like what you wrote or what you did, and you're not going to get anywhere with those people either. So just best to back off, accept it for what it is, and tell yourself, okay, this is either criticism that I can take and learn from, or this is just an a-hole troll and I'm going to completely ignore it and put it out of my head.
Now, there have been cases where some authors have gone to the internet, you know, gone to their groups after a bad review, and that's turned into a firestorm against, you know, the reviewer. Let's say the reviewer was an author, where they've been hit by one-star reviews. I mean, it's really bad how fast it can turn vicious.
Well, and you know, I've heard, and gosh, it's been a little while now, so I don't have the specifics, but I've heard of things similar to that, where one reviewer will get this whole gang together to start knocking down an author's ranking, you know, leave all one-star reviews, leave all shitty reviews for whatever reason. And I don't know how much legitimacy there is behind that, or how that's policed by Amazon and Goodreads, how that can be controlled. But it does seem like it happens if you piss off the wrong troll, and then they come out of the woodwork to get you.
And that, you know, it's unforgivable if an author is involved in that, in my opinion, you know, because, you know, as a community, we need to hold each other accountable to our craft. But, you know, it's whether I criticize your work because I don't understand it, I don't really feel that's my place as, you know, one peer to the next, because, you know, you have your own journey. And, you know, if your writing's not any good, then, you know, your readership and your sales, it's a self-resolving problem, you know. So I don't need to get involved in that. But if you start saying incredibly, you know, racist things, or, you know, just falling off the deep end, or, you know, just then there is some personal accountability, like in any profession. You know, as an engineer, if there's another engineer that is dangerous, I mean, they're so bad, they're dangerous, then, you know, I hope there is a professional accountability that needs to be taken place so that other people don't get hurt. You know, but in terms of creative talent or raw talent or lack thereof, you know, people's opinions are the opinions. And I don't see where authors need to be involved in that at all.
And my whole idea is, And the reason we do this show and reason that several shows like this exist is that we want to share, we want to learn, and we all want to get better at our craft, whether that craft is writing or design or whatever it is that we're doing. And if I'm having someone just post on my wall or on my site or whatever, trashing me, okay, I'm going to be upset and I'm not going to like that. However, if that same person were to send me an email or a private message on Facebook and say, hey, you know, I read this. Chapter 4 was just a train wreck, man. You know, I don't know what happened with this. You know, what did you do with this and this? I'm much more likely to say, well, let me open up that document and see what happened in Chapter 4, because maybe it was a train wreck. You know, I'm open to criticism. I feel like we all should be. But, you know, we just can't be a-holes about it either, though. We got to be. Well,
and also, you know, I'm kind of an engineer geek, right? So, and Elliot can attest to this being an engineer as well, but you know, I kind of look at reviews, you know, as a distribution. You know, what's the majority of input am I getting, right? One or two, one excellent review and one horrible review. That doesn't mean anything, but in context of the whole, what generally am I getting back from my reviews and feedback? That, I mean, as an author, if I could give any advice, that would be it. Is just look generally, what is your response to the, of your work?
Yeah, because you're not going to please everybody all the time.
No. No, and if you're looking at your book that has 100 reviews and you have a 4-star rating, you know what? You're doing okay. If mm-hmm. you're looking at your 100 reviews and you have a 1-star rating, well, maybe time to take a step back and really go through that manuscript and work with an editor or another professional to help you go through it. But I think you're absolutely right. Look at the average of things. You know, you're not going to make everybody happy. None of us can, even me. And I am pretty great. So now you guys have both.
Jason, is you can go to the community. You know, there's tons of groups out there that are there's geared towards indie authors of specific genres. So you got your horror authors, your romance authors, your paranormal, what have you. You can go to the community and you can ask for help. You can ask for them to review your work or to give you feedback on things. And a lot of times you'll find that the community is very open and very welcoming and helpful. And if they can't give you exactly what you want, they can guide you to where you're going to find the right information.
That's true. I mean, I've beta read probably 2 or 3 dozen of her other authors, you know, just kind of run through there and give them as best instructional advice as I could, not so much editing, but just really saying, hey, this is how you can tighten it up or up your game some, because again, you know, there's plenty of readers out there. I don't have to compete with anybody.
No. Now, we've talked about negative experiences online. Have Terry, either you or Elliot, had any overly positive experiences? And by that, I mean, do you have anyone that actively pursues you online because they're a mega fan, or maybe they have a little bit of an internet crush on you and write you all the time, anything like that?
Not to that degree. I get,
you've got a story. Tell me the story.
No, I do get nice emails now, and I get, emails from people where you think, how did you even find my work? How are you reading it? So I've had people from like different film companies in the US email me and, you know, say, I'm a fan of your work, blah, blah, blah. Let me know anytime you release stuff. And to me, that's strange because, you know, I'm thousands of kilometers away, you know, not even in a major city, and they're emailing me from LA to say nice things. But I haven't had that kind of creepy super fan. I don't know if I should say creepy. I haven't been pursued by
anyone. Do you have any stalkers yet?
Excuse me. No, I'd be flattering at first, I think, and then maybe it'd get a bit much.
Yeah. I know. I think it'd be kind of flattering, too. Like, nobody wants to stalk me. Why does no one want to stalk me? Come on.
As long as they live in a different country, I'm cool with it.
That's right. I'll call that. Now, Katie, what about you?
Nope. No stalkers.
Are you serious?
No stalkers.
What?
No, I don't even get weird private messages, not even dick pics. So, you know.
What?
Yeah.
Wow.
Although I think we had said it on a previous episode that that was like the mark of knowing when you've made it is when you start getting dick pics.
Yeah. Maybe it's maybe we got to do something different with your outfits or something.
Something tells me your email is just going to fill up now.
We've got a picture on our page here that says it's the normal ones you've got to watch out for, not the crazies.
That's true. That's very true. What a terrible mark to aim for, though. Excellent. Well, I suppose you might be right. Go indie now. So, Elliot, you're across the world. In fact, Elliot is in tomorrow, right now. So I want you guys to all let that sink in. Elliot is in tomorrow. It's still baffling to me how this all works. So what my question for you is when you're selling books and when you're writing your books, I don't know a good way to ask this, but do you tailor your books to a worldwide audience, or are you tailoring them to an Australian audience? How are you crafting them?
I do struggle with that a bit. So I think my books have actually become more Australian over time, in that I've sort of stopped worrying about if references are too different to someone from, say, the US. But I do sometimes consider it. So if I'm introducing something a little bit weird, I will kind of put an explainer in there, try to make it as natural as I can. But just to make it a little bit accessible, I did write a recent story for the sports edition of Canyons of the Dam. And without one, I
said, it was a cricket. Sorry, I interrupted you. Now you're totally frozen. Elliot. Elliot, you're frozen.
What happens when you time travel to tomorrow?
that's right. All right, Elliot, you're back.
Yes, I lost you mid.
Yeah. Wait, go back. You were trying to tell us you just wrote something for the sports edition.
Yes, so I wrote a cricket story for the sports edition of Canyons of the Dam, and I set it in sort of rural parts of my state, and I let loose with, I guess, the lingo, the vernacular. It's very, very Australian, and for that one, I just decided to not worry, not worry what outside audiences, how much of it they could get. I thought I'd go the train spotting route, I guess, and just go full on with the culture and the sports terms and the cricket and the slang and the swearing.
I would like you to give us a very Australian statement, something that might seem really foreign to the rest of us.
All right. So it's Easter Sunday here. I don't want to be too stereotypical. and I can't do it without swearing. So I know this could be a family audience for this show.
I doubt that right after I said dick pics, so don't worry about it.
Yeah. You don't know. Families are into all sorts of stuff. I don't know. I think the problem is because I've been overseas and I've been in the States a few times and I've been in the UK and all this different parts of South America and stuff, is that the worst slang is when I don't actually realize it's slang. So there's lots of stuff that, you know, I can account for and speak slightly more American, but sometimes you'll just let slip and you'll get a weird look. So what was it like catching a taxi in the US and you've got your bag and you go, I'll just chuck it in the boot. And which means just, you know, put it in the trunk or whatever, but just stuff like that where you're just a little bit too casual or, yeah.
Now the hood is the bonnet, right?
The hood is, yeah, the bonnet and the trunk is the boot.
Okay. All right.
Instead of putting it in there, you just chuck it in there.
Okay.
Like, so I just chuck it in there. She'll be right.
Now, so when you're looking at your sales, because when I look at my sales for any of my stuff, the majority of it is in within the US. Do you find the majority of your sales are within Australia, or are they kind of scattered everywhere?
Mostly in the US, which has always been the case, and I'm not 100% sure why. And when Young Slashers started to take off, that was all in the US. A little bit in the UK. I don't sell very well in Australia, but my excuse is that people here don't really read ebooks quite so much as they do overseas. So unless, you know, you're in the traditional bookshops, you pretty much don't have a shot anyway, so why bother?
Interesting. Now, Terry, what about you? When you're writing a book, are you thinking of any specific audience, or are you, because you write more, now, actually, I'm not going to say that because it's not necessarily true. You don't really write in just one genre, do you?
Most of my writing is in science fiction, and what borders on science fiction. So I write, no, I don't write for one particular demographic group or another. You know, what I try and do is with my novels and such, I try and have a very wide range of beta readers from all different aspects and walks of life so that I can try and increase the readability to, you know, a large majority of people who might be interested in it. So like for the science fiction, the science aspect of it is not a key element of the story. It's kind of a swing, sometimes a plot mechanism to get things moving. But the story itself is about the people, relationships, and the struggles. Yeah, stay away from like brand names and, you know, particular cultural references, just to kind of keep generic.
You're breaking up there a little bit. Was he breaking up on your end too, Katie?
Yeah, I didn't catch half of that, unfortunately.
No, okay.
Oh, again, I'm saying I try and get broad audience for my beta readers, and that way it increases the readability of the books so that if anybody's interested, they could read it without getting lost or with the science or what have you.
Okay.
It's a pretty popular genre, too. So you're going to get a wide audience just for being a sci-fi author.
Yeah, and I think, you know, like I said, I do pay attention to the relationship aspect of the story element. And I had a lot more female readers than I would have anticipated. I really kind of expected to be a bunch of mid-age guys, but it actually the opposite happens. So.
Awesome. Well, you've got something that I can actually see it up on your shelf next to your television, Joseph. And this is not sci-fi at all, right?
No. That was that's completely opposite. It's historical fiction, and it's I'm not particularly religious, but I've always thought that the story of Joseph and the Nativity was a story there that just needed to be told. I mean, he kind of had a tough road to hoe, to speak, you know, and that was a tough story for anybody to do. But I thought, you know, any person out there who's had to do the right thing, regardless of whether they wanted to, could identify with Joseph. So I thought I'd take a hack at it and just kind of give a different perspective to that.
Okay. And that's something that I didn't realize you had written that. And it's funny enough, I had come across the cover to that book online somewhere. It must have been shared somewhere at some point, and I didn't realize it was you, but I remember being intrigued by the idea. So, and that's one of those that I would really like to read, because I love historical fiction. I love it when there's just enough fact that you can really put yourself in the situation and say, okay, well, this kind of coincides with things that I've heard before or read before. So I think that's a really neat idea.
Yeah, I did a lot of research for that because as part of doing the research, I found that there was a lot of texts that were written at the same time as those that were included in the Bible, but they weren't. And add a lot of contextual information to the characters that, Joseph and Mary, that you just never hear. You know, we get fed this Hallmark version of the two, and there's a lot of stuff that was written back then that just wasn't included. And I actually included in the back of the book a reference because, you know, as people are reading through, they're like, oh, God, Terry, where'd you come up with this stuff, you know? But it's in the back there, and it's, you know, a lot of it is just what's been written already. I just kind of spiced it up for modern day audiences, you know.
Okay. Now, you guys both write for let me get some visual aids here down from my shelves. So, Katie, tell me, do we still have Terry on the screen, or am I on the screen now?
You're on the screen still.
Okay, cool deal. It wasn't changed on my end. So, all three of us, Terry, Elliot, and myself, have written for Tales from the Canyons of the Damned. And this is a monthly publication put together by Daniel Arthur Smith. A great guy, great writer, and somehow he's sucked in this enormous group of very talented people, and then there's me at the tail end. I'm like trailing behind you guys, but I was wondering how did you guys get involved with Tales from the Canyons of the Damned? Because it really is a strange publication. There is like trying to describe this for me is so difficult to people because it's a mix of sci-fi and horror and just. There's so much cool stuff in here that is just bizarre and whacked out. How did you guys get involved with Daniel and this publication? Elliot?
It's going back a bit. So I think I've had, say, 4 or 5 stories in Canyons of the Damned so far. And I'm trying to remember back how I first got in. And I know I had a story called Bloom, which is a really cool kind of... magical realism story set on an island, and I never really had a place for it, but I loved that story. So I somehow stumbled across Canyons of the Damned and messaged Daniel saying, hey, I've got this really great story that's too weird to send anywhere, would you want to take a look at it? And he did, and he put it in there, and that was my Canyons debut. I think it was issue number 4, so early days. And then after that, I just do it because it's fun. You're open to a lot more experimentation with that format as well. Like, I can write something that's a little bit out there, a little bit crazy, and you get, you know, instant feedback from the readers. You don't have to be sitting it on a shelf for months at a time. And it's just good for that sort of creativity, I think.
Yeah, I love writing the short stories for Canyons, especially if I'm in the middle of a longer project, because it's like a really cool, not quite instant gratification for me, but it's, you can have an idea, or you guys might be talking about something in the Big Canyons group chat, and I'm like, oh, that would be cool for a story. And you know, you knock a story out in a couple days, and it's like, all right, I accomplished something, and then send it to Daniel, and then Jessica chews it up for you, and then you get it back and cry and fix it. But what about you, Terry? How did you get involved with Daniel?
I think, if I remember right, I had been writing a few stories for the future Samuel Peralta's Future Chronicle, and had a couple of stories published in there, and that's quite a large collection of super talented people, and I'm not sure how they let me in the door on that one, but... did some writing in that group and was exposed to Daniel, and probably through some cross posting, he mentioned Canyons of the Damned, and he offered a couple of times, and I just got busy and wasn't able to do it. And then finally things slowed down, and I was able to get a story that I had been wanting to write for a while about what if we finally broke the code to the whales' language? You know, all the mammals of the sea finally broke the code, and what if they had something completely unexpected that we just didn't expect to hear. And as much that those mammals, you know, have been around much, much longer than we as humans. So, you know, what if they've got a lot more wisdom or things to think about? So that was, it's called Voices from the Deep. That was my debut with Canyons of the Damned. And then I had a second one come out, I believe it was in December timeframe. And it had to do with, a doctor who was a bit full of himself that ends up being patient zero of the zombie breakout at Christmas time. So
awesome. Well, I read something very, very disturbing of yours. It wasn't in a Tales from the Canyons of the Damned. It was in another, what I consider a kind of a closely related publication. It was in something called the Doomsday Chronicles. Yep. I believe that. Yeah.
And I think it was in Samuel Peralta's, as part of the Future Chronicles anthologies. Yeah.
and I believe it was called The Journal.
Yep.
And this, when I finished the last page, I've got to tell you, I was not very happy with you. This whole time, those last couple pages, I was like, yes, I feel this lift inside me, and then you just freaking crushed it.
Yes, I succeeded.
But that was a very different story from a lot of what I read in The Canyons and other anthologies, where it was told through the point of view of this young boy. How old was he? 12, 13, somewhere in there?
About 11 or 12, yeah.
11 or 12. And he was journaling the approach of this this comet towards the Earth, and it was very well done. And even in your author's note, which was excellent, you were mentioning how so many times in these tragic situations or these dire circumstances, we're forgetting how the children are impacted and how they see the world. And I thought it was a really cool way to approach a doomsday story. And it was very emotional. It was spot on, very well done.
Thank you. I appreciate that. You know, that's, I think some of the best stories I've read by other authors are the ones that they take a common story, but change it from the perspective that's being told, you know, because a lot of the tropes and stories they've been done 1,000 times, but what makes it yours is the perspective which is told. And you're right. I my kids teach me stuff all the time, and I constantly have to remind myself that, you know, they're just a few years into experiencing this thing we call life. And, you know, I've got a lot of legacy with how things work, but this is all new to them, and they don't have the perspective or the context to frame this all. And so I've always thought, you know, what would a situation like a comet racing towards Earth with no clear obvious if it's we're going to survive or not, how would I be if I were 10 years old, and how would I suck that information in and process it? As a spoiler, the comet doesn't hit Earth, but other bad things happen. So
yes, very bad things. And so you're a NASA engineer. Are you still working for NASA now?
Yep, still working.
Okay. Now, has your career with NASA, do you think, has it influenced your writing in any way?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, my goal was to take a lot of my experience with, working with astronauts, understanding the information, how it affects their physiological body and also mental state, what it takes to travel in space, what kind of hardware they have, what kind of technologies there, and try and make the experience as real as possible without just hammering people over the head with it. It's the subtle details that make it real, because I can barely watch science fiction movies because the details are just so horribly done wrong, and I just can't watch most of them for that reason. So my goal and my commitment to the readers was to try and make it as real as possible, but still keep it interesting.
I love that. Now, here's a question. We'll start off with this one. Have you read The Martian?
I was just about to mention that too.
did you enjoy The Martian?
The book is much better than the movie, obviously.
Oh my God, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, the movie was pretty good, but then they started doing stuff towards the end, and yeah, it just is impossible. But, one of the nice things that Andy did was, while he was writing the book, he had a lot of people, engineers in particular, involved in the space community, give him feedback along the way and said, yeah, we'd never do it that way, or this is what we'd really do. And, granted, he's probably like an uber MacGyver, and that human probably doesn't exist. But, technically, if a person were smart enough and the resources were in place, that you could actually do most of what he did.
And I didn't want to read The Martian at first when it came out, because there was so much hype about it, and I was like, I usually don't go for the stuff that's got tons of hype. And then my best friend told me, you have to read this book. It's probably the best book I've ever read. And I'm like, all right, I'll give it a shot. And I was shocked reading the book, because it's science fiction. And I would call it hard science fiction, because most of it's based in good hard fact. It's very detailed, but it's so readable and funny as hell. I mean, I was laughing out loud reading that stupid book, and my wife was looking at me like I'm an idiot. I'm like, honey, you're just going to have to read this. It's fantastic. And I just thought it was a genius piece of work, because even though I don't know that much about hard scientific fact, I felt like it was very realistic. I felt like, holy shit, man, this is really how it would go down. And I think all of that just added to this incredible amount of suspense that he put into the book. It was cool, man. I was a big fan. So
yeah, I mean, I corresponded back with him a little bit back and forth on Facebook, and he's a nice guy. And this, it was a whole phenomenon with the book. It just really kind of caught him off guard. He had some readers, and it was going, people liked it. And then people were like, hey, why don't you pull this together and put it in like an ebook so we can download it? And he's like, well, okay, I'll look into it. And then he said, well, I can do it on Amazon, but I can't give it away. They're going to make me charge 99 cents for it. And people were like, yeah, please, at least it's all in one place. And then within like a month, it just mushroomed into this giant thing. And then a month later, he's got people calling, wanting to make movie deals, and he's still, his head's kind of spinning. So, you know, I think we're all looking for that kind of a situation.
Well, hell yeah, that's the dream, man.
I think most of us would sell our soul for a movie deal.
Well, I told people at work, I said, as soon as I get my movie deal, there's going to be a big cloud of dust between my desk and the front gate. So,
Elliot, what are you working on over there right now?
So I'm working on a couple of stories, which is, I don't mind it. It means you don't work as quick, but you get two books out of it in the end. So I'm working on like a pseudo sequel to Young Slasher, which is, it's quite different. It's not like a follow-on sort of sequel. It's more of like a parallel sequel with a different character and paths intersect and stuff. So that's called Young Cannibal. So it's right into the, I guess, the cannibal genre of horror movies, but with a really, I guess, emotional core. I like to put in a lot of, I like to put in characters you can root for, even if they're doing bad things. And then I'm also working on a story called Featherfoot, which is a lot harder to write because I'm running in a different style, and it's based on an Aboriginal myth story, Dreamtime story, about this being that essentially kills people as part of the whole revenge system, honor system sort of thing. So that, if it ever gets finished, will be very, very interesting. It's a lot more serious than I guess Young Slasher and that sort of stuff, where I try and make it fun, try and make it like an 80s horror movie. So yeah.
How do you go between writing two stories at the same time? I mean, it's gonna be hard to years like that.
Yeah, I just follow my mood. And it's interesting because I think it almost helps that they're quite different, in that one, one's first person present tense, the other one's third person, this and that. So I think almost being a different story, once you get going, your paths don't cross too much because they're completely kind of different, and I'm writing it in quite a different style as well. So I'm doing okay so far.
Elliot, do you outline or are you a pantser?
I outline in my head. Yeah, so I'm mostly a pantser, but I always know where I'm going.
Okay. I don't know if outlining in your head quite counts as outlining.
I don't know. I do this thing where I just like to know where I sort of break the book into quarters, and I know where I want to be at the end of the first quarter, the second quarter, the third quarter, and at the end. And then I fill in the gaps. So I think the story has a shape, but the paths getting there, I leave open to my inspiration. Because if I try and outline it, just doesn't, it doesn't work. I change my mind anyway.
Yeah, and I feel like too much outlining kind of takes some of the fun away from it too.
Yeah.
you know, it's writing this discovery writing thing. It's exciting, but then when you get stuck, it's like, well, shit, I wish I had an outline for this.
What's interesting is most of the authors that we've talked to are pantsers. I mean, every time we've interviewed an author or a group of authors and we ask this question, the majority of them lean towards the pantser side of the spectrum.
I'm totally an outliner because I have to be, because, you know, I only have an hour here, 10 minutes there, and write a couple stories at the same time. So, you know, if I have it all laid down, almost down to the scene level, then if I get writer's block or have 10 minutes here, I can kind of jump in and say, oh yeah, this is what it was, blah, 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 and kind of go through there. But I mean, there's some revision, but this just works for me, I guess.
No, that's awesome. We've talked to a couple people that are meticulous outliners and their writing process is so foreign to me, but they are so on top of their game. I mean, they'll have character charts and scene charts and they know everything about every person and what's going to happen. I'm like, that's brilliant. I can't do it.
I guess that's where I'm a pantser when it comes to character development. I don't do that detailed outline of the character, personality and stuff. I let that kind of evolve with time. But usually the word count of my outline is about 10% of the final length of the novel.
Okay.
And I think it also depends on what you're writing. So hard science fiction, historical fiction, like Joseph, it's a lot more detail orientated. You need to do a lot of research ahead of time. And I think it would be a lot harder to say you couldn't write The Martian as a pantser, because you need to have all this background information and you need to know where you're going. I wrote, I guess, a historical fiction story for Oceans, and I found that incredibly hard because at the back of my mind I was always worried if I got a detail wrong, if I took too far of a creative liberty, that someone could always go, hang on, that's not what happened, that's not what that bloke was like. So I do think you need to have it much more planned if you're going to go something that's that sort of fact-orientated.
That makes a lot of sense. It does. Oh, we've got a question from someone in our audience. They asked if Elliot is still running his work through writer groups.
My writer groups? I don't know what that question is. Sorry, can you say it again?
He looks lost, Friday Ketchup. Can you clarify? And also Friday Ketchup said that he had two hot cross buns for breakfast.
Oh,
so I don't know if that means anything to you, because to me hot cross buns is actually just a song that you
No, they're actual buns.
Yeah, I've got some here if you want one.
Yeah, can you show me what a hot cross bun is?
I can. I'll go fetch one for you.
Yeah, go fetch one for me if you would, please. Throw it in the boot.
Oh, good Lord.
Sorry.
This is why we don't teach any words, Jason.
I have still, one of my goals is to use the word smote in a story and use it correctly. I'm desperate to be able to make that happen. All right. We've got some magic happening here.
Let's see it. That is a hot cross bun.
So it actually has a cross on it.
It does. It does. It's got a little cross on it. So I think it must be a British thing if the Americans don't do it, but we do. It's like a spiced bread bun. So there's raisins and bits of apple and all sorts of stuff in there, cinnamon. And then they put like a little cross. So the cross doesn't really taste like much. It's like flour and water, essentially, and it's like a harder sort of cross. And for whatever reason, because we don't really do Halloween here, we don't do Thanksgiving, we don't do that sort of stuff, but Easter we do quite big, and I don't think it's as big in America. Like we've got two public holidays, so we get a 4-day weekend. They're selling hot cross buns from about the 1st of January. Like they're right on it these days.
Okay.
So you go to the shops. They do chocolate ones. They do fruit free ones if you're boring.
So is hot cross buns, is that somehow related to Easter? Is it an Easter thing?
Oh yeah, so they're an Easter thing. So
Okay.
Hence the I guess. But it's just a thing.
I always thought it was more of a Scandinavian thing than British, but
maybe I'm not sure. It's very much an Australian thing now, at least. So we stole it from somewhere. I'm not sure.
Well, they appropriated it. It's theirs, and that's it.
I heard that Australia, because Australia used to just be a continent, I heard that Australia is now also a country. Is that true?
Are you winding me up? Yes. Interesting news article about the quality of education in the United States. We're very much a country.
All right. Now, whereabouts in Australia do you live?
So I live in Queensland, so you'll know where Sydney is.
Yes.
So go to Sydney and then drive north about 1,000 kilometres and you'll be in the great state of Queensland.
Oh, okay, okay.
Very yeah, cool. So it's known for being hot all of the time and for not getting cold. So it's nice weather, nice beaches, rainforests. And if you head up north a bit, the Great Barrier Reef is in Queensland.
That's awesome. Now, you are a bit of a world traveler. At least you were last year. You did quite a bit of traveling. Now, do you have an actual day job that you do, or do you just write and travel?
So I did take quite a bit of time off. I'm doing stuff again now. Don't you worry. But you know, back in the real world. But for a while there, I just sold everything, packed up a backpack, and somehow made it from Santiago, Chile to Toronto, Canada, mostly via land. There were a couple of flights in there for, security reasons. But most of it was done in buses and shuttles and stuff like that.
Now, when you're traveling, do you write while you're traveling or do you not write at all while you're traveling?
I tried to write while I was traveling, but it's quite hard. My output did diminish noticeably during that time. It's just tricky because I feel like writing, it helps to have a routine. Yeah. So it helps if, you know, you're getting up the same time every morning and you're doing it then, or you know you've got time at lunchtime to do that. And I feel like traveling, you kind of never know whether you're going to be in the back of a bus one morning. In, you know, going out to the jungle the next day, it's like you kind of don't have those yeah. down times.
But you've got all these amazing experiences now to draw from. And that's my next question is, do you draw from some of your traveling experiences in your writing or not so much?
I sort of do. I haven't. I did write a pair of stories, The Canyons, where most people won't even know they're related, but the first one is about a young man that wants to travel, and it's sort of picking from bits of my experience. And then the second bit is when he's coming back and he's going through Australian customs. So it's sort of like the bookend stories without, you know, the actual travel bit in the middle.
Okay.
But I always worry about, like, it's hard. I feel like, you know, if you've been in a country for a month or two, you can't, like, I feel like I don't have the right to write too much of that culture into my stories, and that, you know, there's still a lot I don't know. I don't have much of an ownership over that culture. But I tend to just ramp up the Australianness now.
Okay. Well, now, I read something very disturbing from you. And you write a lot of disturbing things, by the way. But this is an old one. I was bringing up old issues of stuff, and it was Mia versus the vegan cannibals, something like that. Does that ring a bell?
Yes. So that's actually it's in the Doomsday Chronicles. So
that was Doomsday too. Okay.
Alongside Terry. And I was struggling before I wrote that because. I got into Doomsday because I'd written Irradiated and like a trilogy of post-apocalyptic fiction, and they were really kind of, dark and heavy themes in those stories. And I sat down to write something in that style, and it's almost like I'd excised all of that out of me in writing the trilogy, and I didn't want to write something dark and depressing.
Yeah, because it was funny.
So I spoke to Sam, and I said, look, I know you're probably going to get a lot of, like, really, you know, heavy stories in this issue. Do you mind if I write something a bit silly? And he was all for it. His attitude was basically, you need balance, and he has trouble if all the stories are so depressing. You kind of do need the lighthearted moments to space it up. So I wrote that. It's essentially like a horror comedy about, you know, a conference of vegans that get a pathogen and go crazy. And poor Mia has to fight her way out of it.
I'll tell you, the only way I could describe that story, and the only way I can really describe it, is fucked up. It was a very messed up story.
I will warn you, that's probably one of the more lighthearted horror stories I've written. So,
I mean, I laughed, but at the same time, I was like, am I going to hell for laughing at the end of the story? Because it doesn't feel right that I'm laughing at it.
Oh. I had a funny thing with that. So I wrote it in my traditional Australian style, and I had a lot of swear words in it. And I was worried, knowing that the Chronicles series has a broader audience, that you could, you know, get away less with offending whole bunches of people because it's got such a big readership. So I made the executive decision to go through the story, and everywhere I had a swear word, I sort of replaced it with crazy, almost like a Beck album. Like, I just replaced it with what someone would say if they were trying their hardest not to swear, but had to get that message across. So there's lots of, some interesting alternative swear words.
Well, one point in the story, Mia says frack.
Yeah.
F-R-A-C-K, which I recognize immediately from Battlestar Galactica. And the dude she was talking to was like, okay, God, how did he phrase it? He was like, frack, really? And she was like, yeah, that, you know, that way it appeals to a wider audience. And they're like, what?
Yeah.
Breaking the fourth wall there.
Yeah, I do that a lot. I especially in Young Slasher and stuff, it's very much self-aware. And it's more fun that way. You can get away with it. I'd say that story is inspired by, like, a lot of the 80s horrors where they set out to make a serious movie and then it just came out hilarious. So yeah. Stuff like Evil Dead and Chucky and, you know, stories like that. It's kind of that vibe where it's intentionally over the top.
So have you seen the Santa Clarita Diet with Drew Barrymore?
No, I haven't watched that, actually.
It's the same thing. It's like so over the top, and so I find myself cringing at times and feeling guilty for laughing, but it's out there.
It's good, and I'm not caught up on it. We've watched a handful of episodes, and there's something about it where I just want to keep watching. It's just like, it's so ridiculous, but it's good at the same time. Kind of like The Babysitter. Have you guys watched the Babysitter on Netflix?
Yeah, I love that movie.
That was fantastic.
It's funny, though, because you read reviews and so many people don't get it. They think really? it's just a bad movie.
Oh,
but, okay. you know, if you've watched enough horror movies, you know that it's intentionally being a bad movie at certain points. And if a character's acting stupid, it's not because they're poorly written. It's because they're sort of playing on all the jokes, like all the styles of the people of the movies. Like, I feel like unless you do it really obvious, like Cabin in the Woods, a lot of people, I don't know, just don't see the humor in it.
I think
my favorite show at the moment is Ash vs. Evil Dead, which I don't know if you've seen, but it's based on the old Evil Dead movies, same actor, same director, and it is so ridiculously over the top, and there's so much good practical gore. So people getting their heads chopped off by drum cymbals and sliding off the thing, and just it's so ridiculous that it's probably the best thing I can watch at the moment.
Awesome.
Inspiration.
Can't do it at all. I won't.
Well, so I wanna give you guys a chance to, because an hour has passed and it seemed like it was nothing at all. But I wanna get a chance to hear from both of you on what you're working on right now, or what you might want to tell potential readers to expect from you as your kind of your next work, or do you have a new release that you want to talk about? Terry, go ahead. Take the ball.
Okay, so my work has slowed down a little bit because I've taken on a new job responsibility at work, so that has kind of sucked up all my mental energy right now. But I've got the plan is to take a couple of short stories that I have written and turn them into full-length novels. One of them is Voices from the Deep, that was in the Canyons of the Damned. And that one's got at least one full-length novel in that one. But one that I've been playing with for a long time, for 3 or 4 years, and that's actually why I wrote the journal for the Doomsday Chronicle, because it's been a story that's been in the back of my mind for, oh, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years, and I just couldn't quite... I wanted to try it out. I didn't know how I would build it out, the characters and such, but that one is one that I really want to work on, the full-length novel. And the story itself is going to be the whole life of this young boy, starting, you know, when the comet is approaching, but basically carry it through to the very end of his life and as things kind of slowly unwind and shut down from a societal standpoint. That one I find very intriguing, and that may be the next one that gets written.
Okay. Well, we'll definitely look forward to that. And this is totally off topic, but I wanted to ask you earlier, and I got sidetracked. You helped design the astronaut spacesuits at one point, correct?
Right, yep.
Here's what I want to know. We've all seen the funny video of, who was it, Tom Hanks and Apollo 13, peeing out the side of the lander or whatever he's the module. So how do astronauts poop in space? How do they do that?
Yeah. So, so on the space station and for a little while, the space shuttle, they had it kind of looks like a toilet, like a little room closet with something you sit on that, it's like a vacuum, really, because it sucks air down, and you know, in space,
otherwise it just float everywhere, right?
Right. Once you give momentum to something, and I won't describe what, but once you give momentum to it, the vacuum kind of grabs it and packs it away. But before that, they kind of had to do their best with baggies as they're kind of floating around the cabin.
My lord.
Yeah, it's not very nice.
Wow. Yeah, that is not very nice.
No.
On the issue of defecation, there has been, probably since time began, a debate about Australian toilets and whether or not the water actually flows in the opposite direction as it does here in the Western Hemisphere or wherever we are. So, Elliot, we need you to put this debate to rest once and for all.
As I was explaining to you the other day, you know, we're looking at YouTube videos and stuff. Our toilets don't swell here. So I know in America you've got this huge body of water. It's like Lake Michigan in a toilet. And it's up high and it fills up and then it does this whole little event, you know, to signify that your poop is being transported into the underworld. Here we have, I guess, like a shallower body of water, so, you know, maybe like that size. And when you flush, water just rushes in and it just takes it away. And it doesn't swirl, it doesn't do magic, it just gets it the hell out of there, it just bashes it.
So you've got like a waterfall effect.
That's exactly what it's like, Katie.
Yeah, it's like it comes from, I guess, the front of the toilet and just shoots down like a jet stream and takes it away, so... So the real answer to the question is it's impossible to say because our toilets don't swell. I'm very disappointed that The Simpsons has misled us.
It really has. And that was my... That was one of my main reasons for wanting to travel to Australia, is to witness counterclockwise swirling. But now it's fun.
It's fun. With that episode of The Simpsons, Australians love it because very rarely do we get, you know, a feature episode in a mainstream American TV show. But nothing in it is correct. Nothing. Not even the accents. The accents are the worst Australian accents I've ever heard. But we love it. It's funny.
Well, that's awesome. So, and Elliot,
we don't drink Fosters. I just throw that out there as well. We don't drink Fosters. If I went down to the local bottle shop, I don't think I could even buy it.
Well, you told me that Fosters isn't even made in Australia, right?
No. So in the US, it's made in Austin, I think, or somewhere in Texas.
Do you hear that? It's not even made in Australia, guys. It's not Australia for beer.
And I think in the UK, where it's quite popular, they make it in Manchester. So it's almost just like a brand that they sell out to other countries to slap this on and pretend it's Australia.
It's all marketing. It's all in the marketing. Yeah.
So, Elliot, what can we expect to see from you next? You've got a short story in the sports edition of Canyons, which I believe just released today, didn't it?
Yeah, so today or yesterday, or probably depending on your time zone, it's just launched. It's a sports edition, so it's still, you know, horror and sci-fi, those sorts of stories, but all with a central sports theme. And mine's based around, as I said before, a rural cricket match with some very weird things happening to this dude. So I don't want to spoil it, but it's, if you want to see how, say, a group of Australians in the bush actually talk, it's probably a good place to start.
Excellent. So you can actually go on to Amazon, if any of you are so inclined, and you can type in Tales from the Canyons of the Damned, and there are a lot of different, there's a lot of editions. Do you know how many we're up to now total?
So this is number 23.
Number 23. So there is a lot of really cool fiction in these, including three or four by me, some by Terry, some by Elliot, maybe someday some by Katie, if we can get her to write some horror. But yeah, there's all sorts of good stuff on there. But Katie, is there anything else?
Sorry, I just cut you right off. I was going to say, we can put the links in the description of the video, so that'll make it easier for viewers who are watching after the fact to find it as well.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Well, Katie, is there anything else that you want to talk about tonight? I know we didn't talk to you a whole lot. What are you working on right now?
Yeah, I was just enjoying the conversation.
I know Elliot is magical when he speaks, isn't he?
You know, it's all about the accent. That's it. You just have to have a good accent, and you can just talk all day.
All right, guys. Well, we are actually a little bit over our time tonight, but it was so much fun talking with you guys. Elliot and Terry, thank you so much for joining us tonight on this live edition. It was great to have you.
Yes, appreciate it. I'm very much enjoying myself.
Excellent.
Yeah, awesome to be on again.
Yeah. All right. Well, until next week, guys, thank you so much for watching, and stay tuned for the next episode of Spilling Ink.
Thank you for listening to Spilling Ink.